This is Resonance 104.4 FM. Flipping marvellous. I'm Nick Hennigan, and welcome to another slice of Literary London. Also, of course, don't forget, on bohemianbritain.com. And if you're listening in stereo, you'll also know that you can see us. Oh, yes, we're in glorious kind of vision on bohemianbritain.com and various YouTube channels. And on Literary London this week, it is my great pleasure to introduce to you an absolute bohemian Briton, a man about who is often said but never proved. Oh no, that's my joke, which I thought I'd say, because I'm joined now by Tim Marriott, a performer. Tim Marriott, how are you, Tim?
Hey, I'm good, thank you. Hello, good to see you.
I know, and if say we're waving, and you're in England at the moment now, are you back? You're back in England.
Yeah, I've been away in Australia for 11 weeks and I've just got back, and it's good to be back in the mist and the drizzle and the cold and the grey.
Yeah, it's about to get worse next week as well, obviously.
Oh, great.
Celebrate you.
Must be the cricket season.
Yeah, exactly. We're just ready for that, yeah. So Tim, I mean, wow, I don't know where to start. We kind of know each other from the Edinburgh Fringe over the years. And it's that kind of weird sort of community that appears once a year in August. But also people will know you, I mean, for a long time, you were a household face in a TV program called The British Empire, which was a great comedy. And we'll perhaps talk about that in a bit, but the kind of the exciting news is you've got a new show or a newish show happening in London. It's called Appraisal. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, Appraisal, the tagline for that is it's an annual work review that goes horribly wrong. Anybody who's worked in a corporate environment of any kind or in any kind of work really will probably has the annual appraisal to look forward to when their work is appraised by a senior manager. And that can sometimes be a little bit uncomfortable and can sometimes be a lot of fun. And we've tried to put a real live appraisal onto the stage in 50 minutes. And we're doing it at the Tabard Theatre next week. We open, yes.
Yes, Tabard Theatre, Bath Road in Chiswick, W4. I'll put the link as well somewhere on here. Or, of course, if you're listening on the wireless, you'll just have to search it. Yes, Tabard Theatre, Theatre at the Tabard, Bath Road, Chiswick, W4. excuse me. And we've got to talk about you as a performer because you've done some brilliant sort of solo shows. And what was the desire to put this on? What made you think this would work? Were you motivated or inspired by something in particular?
Yeah, well, I spent, after the British Empire came to an end, I spent 17 years in a teaching environment. I left the world of TV comedy behind in 2000 and took a job as a senior teacher in a school, in a secondary school, which was fantastic. During that process, I learned that I had to be appraised every year and I had to give appraisals every year. And one, I think I was probably having come from an acting background, I took everything very personally when I was appraised. If I wasn't 110% in the assessment that I was given, I was very upset. So I was probably a terrible person to have to appraise. But I'm also not sure that I was very good at appraising other people either, because it kind of puts you in a false position of judgment over other people, which it's very hard not to be patronising and a bit pompous in that situation. And I probably fell into that hole a few times. So there's a bit of self-knowledge involved. And having had the idea that it would be quite fun to satirise the appraisal process in a play, one obviously then does a bit of research and talks to lots of people who've been through a process and people who've had comfortable experiences and people who've had slightly less comfortable experiences. And so we put those together and created a real live 55 minute appraisal on stage.
I must confess, I saw one of the very early iterations of it in Edinburgh, which was what, 4 years ago, maybe?
No, 2 years ago.
Was it two, the original one in the little cabinet in the
water
cabin? Was it two? Oh, it seems longer than that. And that was fantastic. And you were still very much a work in progress, and you weren't performing in it then, were you?
No, that's right. It's one of the joys of employing actors, or not joys of employing actors, is that they have the cheek to get other jobs. So when it came to doing, we ran appraisal just for a few limited performances at Edinburgh and then again at Adelaide in Australia. There's an Australian production of it, just for a limited number of, I think that was just five performances, that one. And my friend Nick Collett played the role quite brilliantly. And then when it came to doing it in Edinburgh, we were given a larger venue and a longer run in Edinburgh last year. And Nick damn it, wasn't available. And, you know, if you want to, if the only person you can really rely on in that sort of circumstance is yourself, really. So I was persuaded to take it on myself and perform opposite the wonderful Angela Bull, who's done it right from day one. And Angie and I did it together at Edinburgh this year, and well, this year, the last Edinburgh Fringe was 23, of course. And we took it, you know, took it on a bit and made a few changes and developed the piece a little bit. It's been a work in progress for a long time. And now we've got this invitation to come to the Tab Bar, which we're very excited about.
Yeah, I must confess, I saw that original one. I'm really looking forward to the new version, as it were, the improved version. I said improved, the developed version. It's always a thing in theatre, isn't it? I remember some years ago saying to me, quite a famous producer, saying they'd done a show in Manchester and then opened it in the West End, and something happened on the motorway on the way down. And I guess you're an experienced theatre person. I guess in a sense, it's every performance is different because you've got an audience there. Does that make a massive difference?
Oh, and every audience is totally different. It's amazing. Some people, it's essentially a comedy. But if the audience don't, if they don't feel that they're able to laugh, if we don't get some humour into it early on, it can be quite a sticky experience. But then people, what we would like to think of those as a listening audience, people who are actually really tuned in. And I've been told that the play comes across as being uncomfortably funny. And there are some audiences that don't feel comfortable enough to laugh, and others that do, and that tends to change the way that you play it. And I don't think either is less effective or more effective. It's just the way that it's a two-way process. With any performance, is a two-way process. If the audience are responding loudly, that kind of can drive you on in a different way. And if they're listening intently, that can drive you on in a different way. And so every performance is slightly different. Yes.
Yeah, I was chatting with Saria McKellen, as you do.
All right.
Excuse me, about Ian McKellen, because the famous actor who still much prefers theatre to film. I mean, uncomfortably funny is probably quite a good way of describing appraisal. And I speak as someone who's never had an appraisal. I've had a weird life, Tim. I can't hide it. I've had a way, but and watching that as someone who's never had an appraisal. I think in fact, if you go to bohemianbritain.com, I think there was an early review back from that first performance, and it did very well. But there was that the fact I hadn't had an appraisal kind of didn't matter. What was fascinating was the interplay between the two characters.
Well, I think that's essentially what it is. The appraisal is a framing device to put two people on stage who don't see eye to eye. There's an older, old-fashioned male. I think I say the line, "Call me a dinosaur, Nikki, but I prefer to see things in print, in black and white." She says she's going to pull up all the information on her phone, and I said, "I don't want to see that. I want to see it in print. I'm going to go off and get your file." And she says, "No, I don't. I can get it on your laptop." And I said, "I don't do with laptops. Can't be doing with that." So it's an old dinosaur up against a younger, very efficient and very bright female, which he's probably slightly threatened by, but holds the power over because he's the senior manager, and that's an interesting dynamic to play.
It was fascinating to watch, and of course, time, you know, sort of slots into all these kind of things about being woke and you know the kind of I suppose the sense elements, I suppose, of going back to the Me Too sort of campaign, which
yeah, I think if you've got any sympathy for my character at all, it is the fact that he's not so much tiptoeing his way through eggshells but stamping on them.
Yes.
he gets a few things wrong, and I think at the beginning one might be forgiven as an audience for thinking that this is unintentional and that the poor chap's trying to do his best, but as the piece goes on, it gets a little darker and we realize that perhaps he's not trying as hard as he should.
Yes, I mean, I did like that, the fact that he's not an out-and-out baddie to start with. And of course, as you know, anyway, you know, the audience needs to sympathise a little bit with him. And Angela Bull...
A little bit is probably as far as it goes, yes.
Or at least to start with, he's not twiddling his moustaches, which I quite liked. And Angela Bull, of course, who I think is also going to be a guest on Literary London and on Bohemian Britain in the next couple of weeks. She's also an actor that you've worked with quite a lot in the past, haven't you?
And only on this, but yeah. I met her in Edinburgh, as you and I met in Edinburgh. And I was, I met her just socially, actually, when I was going through a very difficult time. I think I was in a play that was causing me a lot of grief, and because I was playing the character of Joseph Mengele, and I was dreaming of having nightmares in German and all sorts. I was finding that quite challenging. And she was, I sat next to her in a bar one night, and she was just fantastically warm and sympathetic, and understood exactly what I was going through, and we stayed in touch, and I've seen her in various other productions at Edinburgh elsewhere, and always admired her as a performer. And so when this came about, I thought, well, who would be better to do this than Angie? And she's proved to be absolutely superb, and at every turn, you know, doing it with Nick and then doing it with me, not easy doing it with different people, and not easy having learned a script and rehearsed a script and performed a script, for me to come along and say, well, actually, I've got a few changes I'd like to make, a few tweaks, and you know, when you've got something in your head and somebody comes along and says, we've got 3 days rehearsal and there are these changes that we need to be making, and for her to just embrace that and go, yep, I'm going with that, was fantastic. She is amazing.
Well, she's from Birmingham originally, that's why you say, Tim. Oh, we're all excited. Right. Yeah. No, that must be quite difficult. I did, if you're watching us, by the way, it seems a poster behind me, Henry V, Lion of England, which is a play, a version of Shakespeare's Henry V, which I actually wrote and performed at Birmingham Hippodrome and in America, but I'm not really a performer. And I remember actually doing on stage and all the tech guys, it's one man show, one person show, but there's a lot of tech involved. And I was adding lines during the performance because I thought they were actually, it would work really well. And it wasn't until afterwards that they were very kind to me. But I remember one of the guys saying, you know, we're 2 pages late for the lighting cue. And I suppose if you're the creator, you can't be tempted to do that, obviously, because you're too professional for that. Once it's done after rehearsal, it's done. But how, let's go back sort of to the start, if that's all right, Tim. So were you from an acting family originally?
No, not at all. I'm from a very traditional southeastern middle class family. I think my dad had a career mapped out for me in accountancy at an early age. But I was the youngest of three, so always fighting for attention. And looking back at it now, I can see why I ended up being an actor. I don't think of myself as an actor now. I think I'm only acting in my own work because I'm cheap and available. available being the key issue was referred to earlier. No, I came from a very traditional background and went to university and got the bug at university, really, rather than school, and went to drama school post-university.
Okay. What did you read at university, if you don't mind me asking? What did you study?
English literature. Yeah.
That would help.
That would, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And that's why I was able to teach later, because I was able to teach English. And then as drama department grew and grew and grew, I ended up teaching more and more drama and became what they call the head of drama and looking after a drama department, which expanded rapidly over the years. And it was really, that was really great fun. And it was a great alternative career for a while.
Yeah, and how was drama school? Where did you train?
I tried the Webber Douglas. It doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, it's now been adopted. Yes,
my yeah, it was fantastic.
Yes, it got soaked up by Central, did you say? Yeah,
I think so, yeah.
Yes. And you had a good time then. And then, so presumably you get to the end of your three-year course, and then what happens?
Oh, I think the first thing I did was I went on a cruise liner. It's funny how the world has, my career has come full circle, actually. My first proper job, my first equity job was stage managing on a cruise liner. Spent 7 months, oh, hang on, sorry about that.
Okay, that's right.
Spent 7 months on a cruise liner, traveling around the world, doing sound and lighting for other people's shows. So developing a technical understanding for how shows work of all kinds was a pretty decent grounding, actually. And then walking through the lounge bar one night, the musical director on that cruise was doing some arrangements and some harmonies for his group that were going to be performing the next day. And he was struggling to get them right. And he said, do you sing at all? And I said, yeah, I sing a little bit. He said, if you could sing the tune to this particular song, and I'll try and work out some harmonies for it. So I did that. And he said, oh, crikey, you do sing a bit, don't you? And I said, yeah. He said, would you like a nightclub show? And so I went from being a technical stage manager to having a little nightclub show in the evenings, which was fantastic. just 20 minutes of four songs and a few jokes, and that was it. That's all I had to do. It was fantastic. And that got me performing again, because I thought, when I first left drama school, I had I don't know how deep we want to go into this, but I had a little bit of an injury that meant I couldn't really act. And it took me quite a long time to recover from that injury. And so technical stage management was a way forward for a while. And then that doing that little nightclub show got me back into performing and got me rediscovering the love of performing. And when I came back to the UK after that long trip, I got into a TIE company, theatre and education company. That led to repertory work, the old repertory system we used to have, the repertory theatre. That led to doing a bit of West End work. And that ultimately led to doing a bit of television in the British Empire, and then back into a teaching career. And when I say full circle, I've just come back from Australia. And what actually initially took me out to Australia was working on a cruise liner, doing one of my shows. I've got several shows up my sleeve, and one of them got picked up to be performed in Australia on a cruise liner going around the coast of Australia into Tasmania and back. And that was amazing. So full circle, I've gone from cruise liner at the beginning of my career to cruise liner at the twilight of my career.
The Michael Palin of theatre. I can see that. I'm Nick Hennigan. This is Resident 104.4 FM. We're also on bohemianbritain.com, and we're talking to actor, well, I say actor, general factotum. No, what's the word I'm looking for? Renaissance man, Tim Marriott, whose play Appraisal is at the Tabard Theatre, Bath Road, in Chiswick W4 in March. People listen to this at all sorts of different times of the year. So if you're not around in March 2024, you might have missed it. But if you're listening on Resonance FM, do search out the Tabard Theatre, Theatre at Tabard, Chiswick W4. It's a massively successful show. It's done extremely well. So with the British Empire, Tim, let's talk a little bit about that, because that's, in a sense, you became, a household name. It was a few years ago when there were only about 10 channels as opposed to the one. How did the British Empire happen?
I talked about the theatre journey that I'd had, and I hadn't really done any television. And the old teaching thing came along. I did a little bit of teaching, as often people do, actors. I don't know if they still do this, but I qualified as a teacher so that I could do a little bit of supply teaching between acting jobs. And it was looking like I was going to be a full-time teacher. And I was teaching at a school on a termly basis. And I got a phone call from my agent saying, could I go up and interview at the BBC for a sitcom? And just as I was about to negotiate a 30-year teaching contract, and the head teacher of the school I was at the time had been saying, look, we need to make this a permanent appointment. And I said, oh, crikey, can I think about it? And it actually filled me with dread, that thought, actually. And that evening I went home, and there was this answer phone message. You know, in the old days when you didn't have mobiles, we had an answer phone, and it was, the light was flashing away, and I pressed play, and it was, you've got an interview at the BBC tomorrow. And I went up and did the most appalling interview. I got it all wrong, I'm sure I did. And said, laughed with the producer about how I was completely wrong for this role, and it was never going to work for me. And or so I thought. And he must have found something amusing in me, because I walked out and went to a telephone box to phone my agent and apologise for having completely messed up the interview. And she said, well, that's interesting, because he's just been on the phone to offer you the job. So you never know, really, do you, with these things? So you can sometimes think you've done everything wrong, and actually all you've done is without realising it, done everything right.
Yes, it's easy to look on the dark side of things. So, back to the British Empire, the character was quite interesting that you played. Was it the first sort of openly gay character or couple?
We believe that it was the first openly gay couple on television, yes. Me and Russell Porter, who played, rather confusingly, he played Tim and I played Gavin. So he had my name and I had another name, I had Gavin. And Tim and Gavin were this gay couple existing in this microcosm world of the British Empire, of Gordon Britis's world. And the joke being that everyone else completely accepted who we were and what we were about, and Gordon Britis couldn't see it. He just thought we were two lads sharing a flat together, to great embarrassment. And that was 7 years in the company, in a relationship with Russell, a fictional relationship, but which I look back on now with enormous warmth and very fond memories, as almost as if it's really weird, as if it was a real relationship. And we're still in touch now. We regularly communicate with each other. And I think he's going to come and see Appraisal when it opens in London next week. He's come to see lots of things that I've done in the past. He's very, very supportive. And I love the man. It's going to be fantastic to see him again.
Is he still acting, do you know?
No, he stepped aside from acting quite a while ago. I think about the same time I did, really. Found the world of comedy and television was a bit limited in the 1990s. And I'm not sure people quite... I think people weren't quite sure where to place us when we came to that programme. So we both got out, both for different reasons, and went in different directions. We're out of contact for a long time. But the wonders of social media and Facebook, we got back in contact through Facebook. And of course, the wonderful Harriet Thorpe, who I'm also in regular contact with, has gone on to become the Queen Vic.
Yes, that's right. She's going to EastEnders, isn't she?
She is, yeah. Yeah, Elaine in EastEnders. She's absolutely brilliant. She's
Oh, that's, I mean, you must, 7 years is quite a long time to work on one job, particularly, I said, and again, it's, you know, it can be very intense, can't it, acting? I mean,
but it's a really strange experience, because for 3 months each year, for about 3.5 months each year, as we got together, we were all incredibly close and we were living in each other's pockets. And then, of course, we disappear and go off and do other things. And then 9 months later, we come back together again and pick up where we left off. And it was kind of a strange experience, but a very happy one. And looking back at it, I'm not sure we appreciated at the time how fortunate we were, how lucky we were. It was an incredible experience. Of course, in those days, there were fewer channels, and we did 12 million viewers at one point.
Wow.
And, you know, you'd struggle to get that doing anything nowadays. We were very, very fortunate. It was an incredible time.
And then when that came to an end, what were your thoughts then?
Well, that came to an end, and I had another a few opportunities or other things that came up. Some pilot scripts came up for other sitcoms, which got very, very close and didn't quite happen. And I was away touring a lot of the time and doing pantos and summer seasons and touring farces and things, and spending an awful lot of time away from home and not quite getting anywhere with the TV career. It wasn't really, as I said, you know, people have had it quite hard where to place us. And I think I didn't appreciate at the time that actually getting very close with sitcom proposals for other series was actually a triumph in itself. And I think I saw it as a terrible failure that kept coming second for things. So when I got the remarkable opportunity to go back into school teaching, I grabbed it with both hands. And I initially thought I'd be a school teacher for a couple of years. And I thought, just, you know, resettle things, do a couple of years, have a regular salary for a bit, and ended up staying 17 years, 17 and a half years later. So it's one of these things you get sucked in, and it was a very good life. It was fantastic. And you come become quite comfortable. And then you're approaching the age of 60, one has a little bit of a reevaluation and thinks, well, I've got some unfinished business here. And I think I'd like to write things. I'd like to perform things again. So I went back to the beginning. I went back to, you know, Fringe Theatre, which is where we met.
Yeah. And was an age thing, do you think, that moved you back into the art then?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was, I'm 17 years as a head of department in secondary education. It's a pretty attritional role to be in. And I think I'd got pretty tired and worn down by it, and I was repeating myself. I had one of the jobs I had to do within the job was to direct production, student productions, and I got to the point where I was doing productions that I'd done 10 years earlier and repeating them, because I'd run out of ideas, really. I was pretty stale. It was time for somebody else to step in, and I didn't fancy stepping down and being, you know, an assistant teacher or a junior teacher again. And as I said, I felt I had unfinished business, and I got this remarkable, I was very, very fortunate. I'd done a little bit of dabbling with some writing, and I got approached by a military publisher who'd published this book written by a squaddie, a diary of his, not of his experience through Afghanistan and Iraq, but through his experience post-service, and about his realization that he was suffering from post-traumatic stress. And I was given this diary to adapt as a solo theatre piece, which was just manna from heaven, really. And I adapted that and cast an actor in it, and it did very well. We took that up to Edinburgh and did very well. And then, as I was saying at the beginning of the interview, the problem with actors is they get other jobs. And so, that actor got other work, and so I cast another actor in the role, and then that actor was unable to fulfill a gig in Exeter to 300 veterans, and I only found out 48 hours before the show that this actor wasn't going to be able to do it, and so I had little choice but to pick up the script and do it myself, having not acted for 18 years. And the audience did that. The audience did that funny little thing, you know, where they stand up at the end.
Yes.
I think we're all trying to get to the bar to get a drink, but
that's
I like to think of it as a standing ovation. And I looked at that and thought, oh gosh, maybe I'm onto something here. Maybe I should do a bit more with this. So that was Shell Shock, and that was very successful. That took me all over the place. And that got me into solo. Having said I'd never, ever do a solo show, I suddenly found myself doing solo shows.
Yeah, I saw it in Edinburgh. It's brilliant. And
oh,
you've got a whole catalogue of solo shows now, was it? So that was the spark.
Was the first one. Yeah. Then Mengele, which was actually a two-hander, which was great. Shell Shock did very well in festivals and didn't do very well commercially because I don't think people wanted to, you know, people the title Shell Shock, which I was stuck with because that was the title of the book. It made people think it was a First World War piece, and that wasn't very attractive in terms of a commercial proposition. And it's when we were funnily enough, I was in Switzerland with staying with some friends, and they took us to Meiringen, which is where the Reichenbach Falls are, and where there's a museum, a Sherlock Holmes museum. And I was fascinated by that. And over dinner that night, we were talking about it. And they said, well, you know, you do this play about post-traumatic stress. You do this play called Shell Shock. Well, of course, Dr. Watson was somebody who must have suffered great trauma and stress because he'd served in Afghanistan he's a fictional character, but Conan Doyle had given him a background of having served in Afghanistan. And by the time Reichenbach Falls happens, he's bereft. You know, he's lost his great companion, Sherlock Holmes, at the waterfall. Conan Doyle even killed off his wife, Mary. So he's a man who's seriously experiencing trauma. He said, well, why don't we write a play about him? And and I thought, well, you know, I'm quite busy doing my other plays. And I thought, well, I'm never going to have time to actually write one about Dr. Watson. You're going to have to do a lot of research and a lot of reading before we can then do anything like that. It would be a huge undertaking to take that on. Well, when will I ever find time to do that? That was February 2020.
And it went on when?
So the pandemic happened, and suddenly we found we had lots of time to write, read and write and create work. So I created Watson with Bert Cools, who is Sherlock Holmes. Anybody who knows Sherlock Holmes will know who Bert Cools was. He wrote all the BBC adaptations of all 56 stories that they did in the early 2000s. And he helped me with it. And that's still running. I'm still doing that show. And then the next one along the production line, so to speak, was Appraisal.
Brilliant. I mean, I saw, in fact, you can see a review of Watson. Is it The Final Solution? What is it? What? I forget the name of
it. Oh, no, that's something else entirely. Yeah. The Final Problem.
Sure, that's it. There's a review on Bohemian Britain anyway, which is fantastic. It's a brilliant show, and your performance is great. We could go on forever, but time is against us. So just to reiterate, Appraisal is on at the Tabard Theatre, Bath Road, Chiswick W4. Search for Theatre at the Tabard if you're listening to us on Resonance. Or I'll put a link if you go to bohemianbritain.com, we'll put a booking link there. Are you going to Edinburgh this year, Tim?
No, I'm not. I've just come back from 11 weeks touring Australia. After the Tabard, I'm going to America to 59 East 59, a theatre in off-Broadway, to do Watson and Appraisal over there in America. And by the time we're going to get to August, I will have been away for a lot of the year. And I thought I might just give Edinburgh a miss this year. The other thing is, I don't know how you feel about the Fringe and other people feel about the Fringe, but I think the Fringe hasn't quite worked out where it is post-pandemic. Mm. Last year, it's almost like it's trying to recreate the halcyon days of the early 2000s and pre-pandemic years. And I think something needs to change. And I think it'll be interesting to see how Fringe develops over the next year or two.
Oh, you'll have to come back and talk about that again.
Yeah.
But that's all we've got time for. Thank you so much, Tim Marriott, for your time. So Appraisal's on at the Theatre at the Tabard, Bath Road, Chiswick W4. And I'll see you next time. I'm Nick Hennigan. This is Literary London on bohemianbritain.com, but chiefly, of course, on Resonance 104.4 FM.